Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. No pressure. President Obama will give his first official State of the Union address tonight after a bruising Senate election loss for his party and with increasingly loud rumblings of, you've been here a year, why aren't we seeing more progress? In a moment, former Labor Secretary Robert Reich and historian Julian Zelitzer. But first, we sent Here and Now's Meghna Chakrabarty to Rhode Island to test public opinion. And Meghna, a job fair in Warwick, Rhode Island seemed the perfect place to test these roiled waters.
Yeah, Robin, it did, because Rhode Island currently has the third highest unemployment rate in the entire nation. It's at 13% compared to 10% nationwide. And the state, as well, is now worried it's going to run out of funds for unemployment benefits. So that gives you a sense as to what was going on there. So if you imagine the scene at this job fair, there were more than 4,000 people in business suits carrying briefcases and clutching resumes, and they were all streaming into a hotel, hoping to make a good impression on the tiny handful of employers who were there. It was pretty sobering.
As we're going to hear, but what did people tell you? Did you hear the same kind of anger that we heard coming out of the Massachusetts Senate race?
I'd say it was more a deep frustration and desperation as well. And as you'll hear, people were very honest with me about their worries.
So what's your name and where are you from?
I'm Ruth Turka, and I'm from Warwick, Rhode Island.
And why'd you come down to the job fair today?
Because I need a job. You think?
How long have you been looking?
Over a year.
Hi, Doreen Toombs. I'm from Coventry, Rhode Island. I've been out of work for over a year.
Well, my name is Jamar Jones. I'm actually from Connecticut. I lost my job. It's been about a year, probably a little bit more than a year.
Brenda Brown. I am from Cranston, Rhode Island.
What brought you to the job fair today?
Well, right now I am completely underemployed for a year now.
Let me guess, it hasn't been easy to find a full-time job.
It has not been easy at all.
I think people who have a lot of experience are being pushed to the wayside for the younger generation coming in who will accept less than what they're worth.
I've been looking online. I even went door to door. I mean, I had a lot of opportunities, but they seemed like they all were shut down. So that's why I'm here. Start all over.
How are you making ends meet?
Live on my Social Security money, I guess. It's not much to live on, so I told my cats already, because I have 4 stray cats that I adopted. I told them we're all going to have to go on diets.
Well, let's see. The savings are gone. 401k is gone. So it's been tough. You know, we just cut back on a lot of the things that we used to do, and if it's free, it's for me.
When President Obama talks, what do you want to hear him say about how the country is doing right now?
Well, hopefully that the economy is getting better, more job opportunities out there for everybody. But as far as the politics, I don't even follow politics.
You got more important things to worry about.
Yeah.
All right. You know, the president, how do you think he's done in the past year?
He does not seem to stand up for what is it that he believed in, what is it that he wanted to do. He just seems to want to please everyone, and so therefore, he just going, you know, neutral.
I feel bad for the poor guy. I mean, he walked into this mess. I mean, I didn't even vote for him because I'm not a Democrat. But I feel bad for the poor guy.
What do you think the State of the Union is? How would you answer that?
It's pretty dismal right now.
It would be the State of the Union is very poor. But I wouldn't say that a lot because people might start jumping off buildings, you know, if the president is saying it. So, I mean, I might say the State of the Union is improving. I might say something like that.
Well, thank you so much. Good luck
today.
Thanks.
All right. Take care.
Job seekers at a packed jobs fair in Rhode Island. Speaking with Here Now's Meghna Chakrabarty. And Meghna, before we let you go, based on what you heard and saw, if you could whisper advice into the president's ear before tonight, what would you tell him?
Well, I'd lean over and carefully say, Mr. President, did you hear how everyone introduced themselves in that tape? Every single person I spoke with has been out of work for a year or more. These people have been struggling to find any work. They've been experiencing extreme economic hardship for the entire duration right. of your presidency. And that, Robin, as we know, is the singular lens through which many people are evaluating President Obama and nothing else. So I'd say, Mr. President, everyone also told me that they want your help. Small-time tax credits will help, but they won't be enough. They want and desperately need a sweeping jobs plan.
Meghna Chakrabarty, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, Meghna will not be whispering into the president's ear, but Robert Reich may be heard, professor of public policy at Berkeley and former labor secretary in the Clinton administration. Let's bring him in now. His latest book is Super Capitalism. Professor Reich, your thoughts on what we just heard, people from a jobs fair.
Well, good morning, Robin. Look, there are six people in this country who are looking for a job for every job that is now available. I don't remember in my lifetime anything that is nearly as bad. And there is a great deal of anxiety out there, obviously, and anxiety is an emotion that's very, very close to anger or quickly turns into anger. So politics are volatile, but more importantly, people are hurting.
Well, but he's expected to talk about jobs and a plan. But we've been hearing from people like you, economists, that it's very hard to bring the jobs back. That's the last thing that comes back in an economy. So how can he quickly produce enough, soon enough, to satisfy people?
Well, the irony here and the paradox is that presidents really do get blamed or credited for jobs in an economy to a degree that they are not responsible for or cannot possibly be. Presidents cannot literally create jobs. Businesses create jobs. Small businesses create most jobs. The Federal Reserve Board, has a lot to do with how much money is in circulation, how easy it is to get credit. So a president really is very much on the sidelines to a large extent, and particularly when the president has to deal also with Congress. I mean, the president can't just snap his fingers and say, okay, we're going to have X or Y. Now, having said that, there are things that a president can do. I mean, for example, Franklin D. Roosevelt, at the depths of the Depression, created a Works Projects Administration. I mean, basically said, look, anybody who doesn't have a job, we're going to put you to work. A president can lead the charge in Congress, saying we're going to have tax credits for small business with regard to creating new jobs. We are going to have even more money out there for Main Street. I bailed out Wall Street. Now we're going to make sure that Main Street is back on its feet.
In fact, if I could just jump in, that's one of your very specific proposals. It's sort of a second stimulus, you say, mainly focused on bailing out state and local governments. Again, that money can get more directly into jobs. And you also mentioned jobs program. But that's all. I can see the dollar signs floating around this. And, you know, that means spending more money. How does he convince people in Massachusetts, for instance, who at least said they're afraid of the, you know, huge budget numbers and the deficit?
That's the problem the president finds himself in, because there really is a huge difference between short-term deficits right now today that may be necessary to get everybody back to work and get the economy going again, and on the other hand, long-term deficits 5, 7, 8, 10 years from now that really do cause a lot of worry and should cause a lot of worry. But most people don't differentiate between the two. They say, look, my family has to balance its budget, and therefore the federal government has to balance its budget. The problem I got into was that I let my budget get out of control, and therefore if the federal government balances its budget, so much the better. We'll get this economy back under control. That's not true, that analogy between a family and the federal government or the federal budget or even the national economy is not an appropriate or realistic analogy, but nevertheless, it's one that is easily understood. And that's a real problem for the president.
Well, and because historically he can point to FDR and the huge spending that lifted up the country in the 30s. But on the other hand, some would say that under the administration you were in, during the Clinton administration, President Clinton did go into office on It's the Economy Stupid, but faced a severe backlash. So tightened the sails and balanced the budget. And you argued against those moves, but some would say, hey, it worked in the 90s.
The big difference, Robin, is that when Bill Clinton came to office, and I was right there with him, the economy was already recovering. The recession just before that had been not nearly as deep as this recession. In fact, this recession borders on a depression, if we had a good definition for a depression. In 1992, 1991, the economy was certainly depressed, but Bill Clinton came in and was already in a jobless recovery, so that by 1995, Bill Clinton could point to a lot of progress. The progress was not really because he did anything. I mean, he took credit for it, and I you know, I'm very delighted and proud to have been part of an administration that took that kind of credit. But in fact, it was the business cycle. What, you know, it's kind of the opposite of Isaac Newton's law. Right. What goes down eventually comes up. But this particular...
Well, I just to jump in, I mean, some would say that it looked good from a distance, the 90s, but part of it was a huge bubble that was going to burst.
Well, toward the end, it certainly got to be a bubble. But you've got to differentiate between the business cycle, you know, again, what goes down comes up, and what has just happened. This is something different from what we have seen. We are in, people call it a great recession, but it has to do with the structure of the economy. And when the administration says, well, don't worry, we're going to be coming out of it, this is only just a typical business cycle, or at least it's a deep reversion of what we normally know as a business cycle, I'm not 100% that sure that that is true.
Well, let's ask you some other things you might want to hear from the president tonight. You've said things like, for instance, helping distressed homeowners by allowing them to include their mortgage debt in personal bankruptcy. Is that, you know, right now we've heard it's structured so that, let's say you have a boat and you can go to a bankruptcy judge and you can get that debt refinanced through the judge, but you can't do that with your home. Is that what you're saying to restructure
that?
Yes,
exactly, Robin. You can do it with a second home. You can do it with commercial real estate, you know, bankruptcy law allows you to reorganize your debt under a lot of these and a lot of different debt, but it doesn't allow you to take your mortgage debt into bankruptcy court and reorganize that. And that's partly because the bankers, not surprisingly, the mortgage bankers, the big banks on Wall Street, for years have said, no, we're not going to allow bankruptcy to go that far. But of course, if people were allowed to declare bankruptcy and include their mortgage debt, they would have much more bargaining leverage with their mortgage bankers. And that's what the bankers are afraid of. They're not afraid of bankruptcy magistrates or lawyers getting involved. They're afraid of giving the homeowner more leverage in getting a better deal if that homeowner cannot pay. But that's exactly what we need to do. That's exactly what homeowners need.
But this idea of, again, government intervening more and, in this case, tightening up regulations on Wall Street, the electorate has seemed to voice against that. We have polls saying that they don't want more government, even if it means, you know, punishing the Wall Street bankers that perhaps brought us to this mess in the first place. So, again, in about the minute we have, what can the president say to convince people that that kind of government intervention is the way to go?
Well, I think that he can say that government is inevitably organizing the market. There is no market without government. The question is it organizing it on behalf of you, or is it organizing on behalf of people who are very rich and powerful and may not have your interests at heart? And that's the fundamental question. I think he's got to say, look, we did have to bail out the bankers, but now, you know, it's got to. I am going to do everything in my power to get jobs, help Main Street, help small businesses, help students with their loans, help people get jobs. And that's all I'm going to focus on right now.
Interestingly, one of the voices we heard from the jobs fair was he didn't seem to do, President Obama hasn't seemed to have done what he said he was going to do. So perhaps Robert Reicher is saying, you know, maybe come out bolder with the things that he said he did believe in initially.
Well, that's right. But also, I remember there was one person at that jobs fair who said, I feel so sorry for this president. He came into a terrible, terrible mess, and it's just, you know, he's getting blamed for it. I feel a little bit that way, too.
Well, we'll leave it at that. And I'm sure others agree. And hear what Julian Zelitzer has to say after a break. Robert Reich, professor of public policy at Berkeley, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robert.
Historian Julian Zelitzer is next.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're previewing tonight's State of the Union speech, and joining us now, Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. His latest book is Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. He joins us from a radio studio right there at Princeton. Julian, welcome as always.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, I'm intrigued by your book title because we heard Robert Reich talk about jobs. A lot of pundits here and nationally interpreted the Massachusetts Senate election as a statement about health care. But if you were on the ground here, you heard now Senator-elect Scott Brown talk more about security. And this was all in the wake of the, Christmas plane bomb. Your thoughts about what President Obama needs to say tonight along those lines?
Look, I think he needs a security agenda, meaning on the one hand, he needs to show how he'll improve the sense of job security. But I do think national security still has to be part of his agenda, or if another crisis emerges, he becomes vulnerable. He has to outline what his vision is for the economy and for protecting the citizens.
But how does he do that and avoid what you write is the mistake that President Johnson made before the 1966 midterm elections? He was so, paying attention to criticism from the right, the Republican right, that he wasn't strong, that he escalated the Vietnam War.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he has to do that. He can talk about issues including diplomacy. He can talk about homeland security and how he plans to improve the holes that were in Bush's system. Those are the kinds of issues many Democrats have called for. But thus far, the president has been hesitant to really take that on. It doesn't necessarily mean moving sharp left, but there are areas that can unite left and center within the Democratic Party.
Well, and you write about something else. We've talked about jobs and the economy, and we know that's going to be front and center tonight. But you write that President Obama has lost his campaign clarity. What do you mean?
I don't know. I think he's been something of an elusive president. I think in the campaign, what was attractive about him to many Democrats was that, unlike Senator Clinton in their minds, he had clear positions. He was against the war in Iraq. She voted in favor of it and then was fuzzy about it. But since becoming president, I think there's more sense that he doesn't. He's a pragmatist. He doesn't have clear positions. What is his position on health care? What exactly is he willing to fight for? Same issues with national security. And I think that leaves him open to attacks from left, center, and conservatives all at the same time.
How does he speak to the left? He's been said to have alienated a lot of liberals who, you know, wanted him to be tougher on the things that he believed in.
Yeah, I think there's a danger of overreaction to Massachusetts. You just jump into the center because of one Senate seat flipping and that you move farther away from the liberals who helped get you into office. Look, a strong jobs program, like was just discussed, would be very attractive, I think, to liberals, but it's an issue that independents would also be pleased with. I think if he just abandons health care, you know, that's going to be a danger to frustrating liberals, but also to giving a sense he's not an effective leader.
But how does he, you know, tell us more about how you feel he navigates this, trying to bring along his core on the left, but also assuage many who have drifted over to the right because of at least what they thought health care was about, which is money.
Well, I don't think you're going to get Republicans into your corner, so I think he should give up with that. That bipartisan dream isn't going to come true. But I think one of the things moderates like is not just someone who's obsessed with deficits. It's also a president who can get things done. There's a sense that Washington is broken, a sense that Washington isn't working, and he's now seen as the head of Washington. I think if he can rally liberals around some compromise with health care and he could get it through, I actually think that would be attractive to moderates as much as some commission that's going to start looking into deficit reduction. It's the perception of leadership that's lacking, and that, I think, is ultimately very appealing.
And crazy question, is it as simple as just sharpening the message? You know, many people just see healthcare, as we said, as money, and not hospitals not allowed to, or insurance companies not allowed to deny you coverage because of a previous condition, which would seem to be something that would appeal to a lot of people, but it's not what we're hearing. We're not hearing that line.
We haven't heard much from the White House. I mean, he had that second joint address that he made to a joint session of Congress where he talked about health care, got a relatively small bump in the approval ratings. But overall, I don't think there's been a message from the White House. I don't think he's put the dots together, connected the dots. And so health care looks kind of messy, and Jerry built the reform that he's proposing. I think he has to pick one or two aspects, like pre-existing conditions, that's in the bill and really explain to Americans what this is about and what benefit it will bring. But I don't think he's done that thus far.
This comes at a time, David Brooks, conservative columnist in the New York Times, points out that it comes at a time when the Gallup poll, at least, shows that Americans have less faith in their elected representatives than ever before. The public not only shifting from left to right, but every single idea associated with the educated class has grown more unpopular over the past year. And David Brooks assigns this to, in part, the Tea Party movement and all its different, you know, tenets, some of them supported by former Republican operatives, some by talk show hosts, but it's there. How does he address that, President Obama?
Well, that's always part of the electorate. I mean, there's always a distrust of government. There's always an aversion to seeing the democratic process at work. And there's always conservative elements in our culture, meaning resistance to taxes, resistance to government. But some presidents have been able to maneuver around that. Lyndon Johnson ultimately was able to push something like civil rights, not because it was an easy thing to do, but A, because he was willing to commit to the moral question of civil rights, but B, he was willing and effective at the legislative process. Ultimately, the best argument in favor of government is going to be a government program that works, and you have to initially get through the resistance. So, you know, I think he has to get something in place. He has to show the stimulus worked, and then he has to get something to show that health care reform can work as well.
Reminded as well that FDR, you've often spoke of his presidency. He faced a movement started by a Father Coughlin. We're going to have a story on that next week, but someone who actually started a political party that everyone thought was going to make a bigger dent in FDR than it did, and we'll take a look at that story next week. Julian Zelitzer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, his latest book, Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Thanks, Julian, for previewing tonight's speech with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll take a closer look at the painting that put American artist John Singer Sargent on the map. That's tomorrow. Still ahead, conductor-composer Pierre Boulez. Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. What now for Toyota? After the world's number one car manufacturer announced it would stop selling and even making 8 of its top models, Toyota says it needs time to figure out why the gas pedal sometimes sticks, something that's been linked to at least one fatal accident. Toyota first announced a recall last November, saying gas pedals were getting stuck on floor mats, but the problems persisted, and last week, a recall on another 2 million cars. Sean Kane is a consumer safety advocate who also works as a consultant for lawyers suing Toyota over safety issues. Sean, we know stuck accelerators in the past have been blamed on drivers. Do you think now we're going to see other car manufacturers handling it?
I think we will see some additional issues. Unintended acceleration is an issue that has affected almost every automaker one way or another, and we continue to see recalls. I think what's unique about Toyota is the sheer magnitude of the problem and the fact that Toyota has a multitude of problems across a number of makes, models, and years that can't simply be remedied with a singular fix. And they've neglected those problems. They've neglected fail-safe designs to prevent the unintended acceleration for years, and now they're paying the price for it.
Well, but others are saying, and Toyota dealer owners are saying, that, you know, this is their company, which has a record of quality control, being very upfront. But in the meantime, what are we supposed to do? Toyota says if you have a vehicle on the recall list, only go to the dealer if you've experienced these problems. Otherwise, wait for the company to come up with a solution. Isn't that somewhat sitting on a time bomb?
It certainly is, and I think it's rather unnerving for a company to tell you, we don't know what the problem is, we're getting around to fixing it. And you know, one of the things that we look back at is, again, the why they got here is because of the lack of fail-safe designs. You know, many manufacturers used a fail-safe design that would automatically bring the engine to idle in the event of the driver's depressing the brake. Toyota does not use that, and that makes the car much more harder to control under these circumstances. And so, you know, it's designs like that that start to show up on the back end where they've been neglecting a problem and they don't have the fail-safe in place to provide driver control in an event like this.
But we understand there is something you can do if you are in that car. And I think I might have experienced this. I thought it was me at the time, that something had rolled under my foot. Some of the debris on the floor of my car had rolled under and locked something. And so now I'm thinking that this is what it was. But meantime, we're understanding that if it does happen to you, you can firmly press on the brake. But also, Consumer Reports has more instructions at their website.
Yeah, Consumer Reports has a nice video on their website on how to shift the car into neutral in an emergency scenario. The likelihood of you having a serious incident is not great, but it's certainly one you need to be aware of, and you need to know how to control that car. Be aware that you've got to practice shifting it into neutral in the event you have a problem.
Well, and by the way, we're reading some reports including one about a Lexus that was returned to a dealership because the accelerator was sticking. And those reporters found that that Lexus was then resold. And, of course, the problem couldn't have been fixed because right now there's no solution. Have you and your research found this to happen?
We found that exact same problem. In fact, we were contacted by some folks in Virginia who had had four separate unintended acceleration incidents in their Toyota Camry. They traded the car in at the local dealer. The local dealer put the car up for sale. They're not concerned about the safety aspect of this because Toyota says they don't have fixed. There's no problem with them. Therefore, the dealer says, we don't have anything to work with. We're going to sell the cars.
Well, and so what do you think happens now, Sean Kane? Again, you have a stake in this. You are a consultant for lawyers involved in lawsuits against Toyota. We've said that many Toyota dealerships say that all of this illustrates that they are demonstrating, you know, responsibility. But going forward, what do you think happens for Toyota? And how might this impact regulation of the auto industry? People may be taking a closer look at issues like this.
Folks want to spin this as Toyota being responsible. Frankly, it's Toyota's irresponsibility that has gotten them into this position to begin with. They're in a crisis mode. This latest action is a company that is in crisis that they created by not addressing the fail-safe and addressing the sudden acceleration problems it had since 2002. Where is this going to end? I anticipate we're going to see more recalls in 2010, and I expect that it's going to cover a wider range of vehicles, makes, and models from Toyota that'll go back to, you know, probably the early 2000s.
Sean Kane, president of Safety Research and Strategies in Rehoboth, Massachusetts, also consulting with lawyers involved in lawsuits against Toyota because of the recent headlines. Sean Kane, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, well, we're going to take a break and be back in 30 seconds with the backstory, and it's a true one, behind that film Extraordinary Measures. It's Here and Now. In the new film Extraordinary Measures, Brendan Fraser plays John Crowley, a real-life New Jersey father with two children who have Pompe disease, a rare genetic disorder that slowly destroys the muscles. Desperate to find a treatment to at least slow the disease, John mortgages his home, starts a biotech company, and finds a scientist, played by Harrison Ford, willing to work with him.
I can't cure your kids, you know that. They're always going to be in wheelchairs, but I think I can save their lives.
The film goes on to detail the many battles the two men wage with each other, against the biotech industry, and against time to save those two lives. It's an incredible story, and it's largely true. John Crowley, his wife Eileen, and their children Megan and Patrick are real. He's now written their story in a new book, Chasing Miracles, and he joins us from the Argo Network Studios in New York with more. Welcome.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Even if people haven't seen the film, they've probably seen the ads for the film or the trailers. Just tell us, first of all, do you think the film largely has it right?
I think they did a beautiful job at taking a very complex story with a lot of medicine, a lot of science, a lot of business and entrepreneurship, and putting it into a movie that I think everybody will appreciate. And there's a lot of humor in it, too, which is in part how we try to live our lives.
Well, let's, for people who haven't seen the film and really have never heard of this before, Pompe disease, fewer than 10,000 people have it worldwide, and it slowly brought your children to, you know, real inability to hardly even move in their wheelchairs. When did you first know they had it?
Yeah, Megan was about a year old when we started to see some signs that she wasn't quite taking her first steps, wasn't quite pulling up in a crib. And at 15 months old, she was diagnosed with this very rare form of a devastating, fast-progressing muscular dystrophy. When we got Megan's diagnosis, Patrick was 7 days old at the time. And we were told there was a 25% chance he would have the disease as well. And we went on to have him tested, and turned out he also had it as well.
And you have another child who does not have it. But here you are, a financial consultant. You're really being told your children, you know, are being handed an ultimate death sentence.
And, that's true.
Yeah. But a lot of people hear that.
Every day.
How did you make that move to mortgaging the house and starting a company to find a solution?
Robin, we moved very quickly from the shock, the grief, the denial, to determination, first to find out everything we could about the disease, and then ultimately to find out everybody we knew who was or could be working on it.
And your company did make some major steps. You developed an enzyme that showed some promise. But then why did you decide to sell your company to Genzyme Corporation, which is based here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a huge, at this point, biotech firm?
We realized we needed the muscle and the experience and the financial resources of a large drug company like Genzyme.
So now you start really wading into the world of research. It's territorial. It's got all sorts of rules and regulations. When you agree to become a part of Genzyme, there's all sorts of ethical questions as to whether or not they can direct research towards your children in particular. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, once you actually develop a medicine, then you've got to get it to people in the clinical setting. And we began by studying infants with the disease, very young kids, and I knew my children wouldn't qualify for that study. But as we began to look about the next series of studies, there was a real debate in the company as to what was more appropriate and who were the more appropriate children to study. And eventually, the physicians decided that my kids would not qualify for this study.
At this point in the story, I would want to, you know, in the dead of night, break into a lab and steal the stuff and just take it home to my children. You did think of that.
Sure. I think any mom or dad in that situation would.
Yeah.
I dreamed about it.
But instead, you go to a university and ask them to do a drug trial in which your kids will be the first ones tested. But of course, they have to get the drugs from Genzyme, where you still work. In the film, the company's called Zymogen. And they're furious and have ethical questions. Let's listen to that scene in the movie.
You want this company to sponsor a drug study for two children whose father is an executive of this company. Have you never heard the term conflict of interest?
There is strong scientific justification for this study.
I'm a doctor, John. I know the research value. But you guys just can't go off half-cocked without consulting us.
You know, I know that there were other families involved in this story as well, but just, you know, staying with you at this point, John,
mm-hmm.
How hard was that, you know, to know that it's there, it's being tested, and your kids were deteriorating at this point, weren't they?
They were. We were told they only had a few months left to live at that time, and we were told that they wouldn't qualify for any of the clinical studies, and it was the only chance they had to have their lives saved. So it was personally an incredibly difficult time for me, for my wife Eileen, for all of us.
Yeah. Well, eventually Genzyme does come up with Myozyme. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
The drug that finally was approved for treatment of Pompe is now called Myozyme, yes.
Right. And what happened for your kids? Did they finally get into a trial?
They did. In January of 2003, about 3 weeks after I resigned from the company, the kids were treated in a clinical study. It was a sibling study to compare the effect in brother and sister with the same genetic mutation. And the early results were just remarkable. They went from having hearts that were 2 to 3 times enlarged. The heart is particularly involved in kids with Pompe. To within 6 months, their hearts were back toward normal. In fact, today, 7 years later, they still take the enzyme every other week, the enzyme therapy. It's a lifelong therapy. And you couldn't tell their hearts from another kid's hearts today.
Well, and that's a wonderful ending to the movie and to in real life. But as you know, there are a lot of people who have questions about so much money and so much effort going into many of these illnesses that these biotech companies are working with that affect, you know, so few people relative to other illnesses. Obviously, you would have mortgaged anything, you know, as you did, for your two children. But what do you say to people who say that's just, you know, way too much money funneled into one rare illness?
No, I think it's important to remember, yes, one rare illness, but thousands of lives saved. Also, too, there are 7,000 rare genetic diseases that together in the United States affect almost 30 million people. So taken together, that's more people than suffer from all cancers and all AIDS combined. And we don't spend enough on cancer and AIDS. But even still, the focus on rare diseases has not only had an impact on people living with those diseases, but by studying these disorders, we're learning an enormous amount about diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, diseases with strong genetic components. And that learning is coming from better understanding of the biology and potential treatments for human genetic diseases. We really are on the cusp of a golden age of medicine, and that's a very exciting place to be.
That's John Crowley. The book from his family called Chasing Miracles, The Crowley Family Journey of Strength, Hope, and Joy. His story is also, of course, featured in the new film Extraordinary Measures. For more about the Crowley family and about Pompe disease, go to our website. We'll link you up to theirs. John Crowley, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
And before we go today, conductor Pierre Boulez with unsettling classical music for unsettling times. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. That's Pierre Boulez conducting the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in Igor Stravinsky's The Firebird, which they'll be performing at Carnegie Hall this weekend. Appropriate, as Boulez has been a firebrand throughout his controversial career, although, as the former enfant terrible gets set to turn 85, Boulez is being called a lion in winter, whose roar isn't quite as frightening as it once was. Here now, critic-at-large Ed Siegel spoke with Boulez as he was about to conduct the Vienna Philharmonic recently at Carnegie Hall, and Ed's here to share that conversation. Ed, a tamer lion, maybe, but still hard to approach?
No, well, he's quite a formidable personality, but he's a very charming guy. It's really quite a disarming combination.
And why conducting two different orchestras in New York? Why is he doing that?
Well, he's about to turn 85 and take a sabbatical from the podium, and he's visiting his favorite American cities, New York, Chicago, and Cleveland, at least his favorite orchestras in those cities. But he insists this isn't his farewell tour. He told me he has no intention of slowing down.
There is always this type of curiosity for things which are still to be discovered. For me, at least, age has hadn't done nothing in this kind to make me, let's say, milder or tamer or whatever.
Pierre Boulez talking to Ed Siegel. They say that conducting, actually, it's true, it lengthens lives because of all the upper body aerobics that you do.
Maybe I'll do that.
Yeah, we should take it up. Well, one of the works Boulez will be performing in New York is Béla Bartók's Concerto for Two Pianos, Percussion, and Orchestra. Let's listen.
Robin, that's from the final disc of a sensational 8-CD survey of the music of Bartók. It's really the definitive look at Bartók's orchestral music, I think. And in these New York concerts, in all his concerts, really, the music's exclusively from the 20th and 21st century.
And that, you know, for people who either listen to the radio, classical music, or go to concerts, that's pretty modern, isn't it? That's unique.
Absolutely. And what separates him even further from the pack of conductors is that the contemporary music that he plays has to meet really rigorous criteria that, to say the least, isn't to everybody's liking.
People say, oh, modern music, I cannot understand anything. And if you don't try to convince them, you never end anywhere. And therefore, that was, I think, the goal of my life, to write music, but also to establish the modern music as a kind of repertoire pieces that people know. And you have an evolution, but you must be part of this evolution and not just be in your corner and do nothing.
Pierre Boulez talking about playing more modern music. Of course, he's 85 years old, so modern, you know, we're not talking about yesterday, but what? From where?
No, but there's a lot of Stravinsky and Bartók, as we've heard already, and he's played a lot of the French Impressionists, Debussy and Ravel. But, you know, it's one other major influence on him, Arnold Schoenberg, who has a lot of classical listeners kind of ducking for cover.
The music of Arnold Schoenberg, we've spoken about it on this program, 12 tones and all sorts of dissonance.
This is what Boulez had to say in defense of Schoenberg and the Second Vienna School, as it's called.
I am convinced, and when you are convinced, you can try to convince other people, I suppose. We must have patience and establish a kind of the long run of the establishment of the music, which seems to first very difficult, impossible, and which after 50 years or 60 years begins part of the cultural heritage.
Now
does seem like tamer now than it did when it first came out. Schoenberg does. But Schoenberg has not just been a big influence, you tell us, on what Boulez conducts, but on what he composes.
Absolutely. I think that that atonal rigorousness is really a big part of Boulez's own repertoire when it comes to composing. And you mix that in with the Bartok and Stravinsky experimentations and the French impressionist soundscapes and throw in some Eastern otherworldliness from Messiaen. And it's just one small step from Boulez, the conductor, to Boulez, the composer.
Pierre Boulez conducting his own composition, Répond. Well, Ed, in his younger days, Boulez was famous for sort of challenging fellow composers, even those with whom he had a lot in common musically.
Well, he's developed more of a live-and-let-live attitude toward fellow composers today, but he'll still go a few rounds with somebody like John Adams, the composer, said that Boulez's music was unemotional. And he shot back that Adams's Death of Klinghoffer sounded like bad movie music.
It's a new Fox series. But those are composers who also work in sort of the atonal way that he does. What does he then have to say about tonal composers?
Well, basically, he dismisses them as useless.
The tonal system has gone through a kind of historical evolution, and you cannot go back. That's impossible. To express what you want to throw in the modern times, if you express that in the language of the 18th century, you know that you miss the point, certainly.
So there you have that. So there's that smack down there. So, Ed Siegel, who among his contemporaries does Boulez admire?
Well, quite a few, actually. This weekend, he'll be performing a flute concerto by countryman and student Marc-André Dalbavy. Others are even less of a household name than he is, but Boulez told me he did enjoy his collaboration with the late Frank Zappa.
It was interesting to see him coming from a kind of a field of music to another field where he was very excited to penetrate.
It's a little more bracing, isn't it, than those classical sojourns by Paul McCartney or Sting.
Ouch. Okay, well, what now? I mean, 85 years old, he has these concerts, but then what for Pierre Boulez?
Well, he's planning a sabbatical from conducting so he can concentrate on composing. He told me he wants to finish this project that he's been working on for quite some time now.
Yes, I want to finish my notation first. That's, I mean, you know, they are... They are constantly interrupted. I do a piece and I wait 1 year and then I do another piece. And I want to have 1 year or even 1.5 years totally, you know, practically isolated from the concert hall and just come back later. I hope I am still healthy enough. That's what you should wish to me.
And Robin, we do wish him many years of good health, but I think it's fair to say that we'll never see his like again.
Ed Siegel, here in Els Critic at Large. Pierre Boulez is at Carnegie Hall this weekend and at Cleveland's Severance Hall the following week. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Ed, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.